Okay, we'll be starting just momentarily. Good afternoon, everybody. Yeah, we'll start just after a brief sound check. Starting approximately 1 o'clock, just in about a few minutes. And today's session is going to be an open session, as we dubbed it, to take up your questions and maybe a few other points towards the end regarding some questions from actually some friends' children on Midrashim. So maybe we'll take it up at the end after we address your questions. We'll start just momentarily. And once you hit audio feed, just type OK, audio OK at the bottom of your screen. That will confirm that the audio is working properly, and we'll start the class. And Nomi, good to see you. Laura and Chaya in Florida, good to see you all. And Anna in Israel, good to see you too. How you doing, Doug? How you doing, Cal?
You're okay, Rabbi. How are you?
All righty.
Got a gang on the phone, too.
Okay. Hello to everybody.
Hello. All right.
Good morning.
Good afternoon.
Did you miss your wife?
What was that?
I'm wondering if his wife was back.
Oh, no, she's not due back until July.
Oh, wow. Hello?
Hello, Naomi. How are you?
Hello? Hey, good. Yeshua also wants to listen to the class.
Hey, Yeshua, how are you?
Hi.
Hi. So it's good that Yeshua's on. Yeshua, how old are you now?
7.
What did he say? Okay, so today we had titled the class an open session. I thought it would be a good opportunity. Everybody's off from work. And this way, give you a chance to ask them your questions. So why don't we start? And hello to Chris. Good to see you, Chris Walega. All right, Doug, why don't we start with you and Cal or Naomi, whoever who would like to go first.
I will defer to others.
Okay. Okay, looks like they're looking to you to start the ball rolling.
But if nobody has a question, I'll ask one.
You start, Greg.
All right, so I'm curious to get your take on this. I work in a company, and I'm the quality director, and we have certain rules that we set up to make sure that things are done appropriately. Now, in any kind of an environment like that, where you're talking about law or local government or whatever, you can put up a certain number of rules, and as long as people think that they're reasonable and acceptable, they'll do their best to comply, generally. But if you make the rules so complicated and so voluminous, after a while, people will feel overwhelmed and just say, forget the whole thing. And they'll dismiss it all. So I'm curious, not so much from a Noahide standpoint, but maybe from a Jewish standpoint, when I look at the Torah law, there's 613 commandments, and if you take out the ones that don't apply when the temple's not standing, I believe you're down to the order of about 200 of them, which is not an unreasonable number of laws to figure out and so forth. But when you add all the rabbinic pronouncements, that starts to add, as I understand it, thousands, maybe tens of thousands of additional things that you have to know and comply with. Now, every one of those rabbis who came up with those, I'm sure, had a very good reason for doing it at the time and could make a rational argument for why their law made sense. But when you add thousands and thousands of them, it would seem that the load becomes so overwhelming that a person could easily look at it and say, this is impossible, forget it. This is just unreasonable to expect any human being to be able to deal with. So I'm curious as to how you might respond to that in regards to Torah and rabbinic law.
Well, I don't have to respond to it because the rabbis did already in Ethics of the Fathers. There's a quote that says, it's not upon you to, and whoever's not speaking, just put on your mute button just so it doesn't conflict. And then when you have a question, take the mute button off. That'll just be, it'll help out the class. Okay, so like I was going to say that the rabbis already responded, and they said that the work is not upon you to complete, nor is it upon you to abandon, meaning the laws of the Torah are not something which you have an obligation to complete. Now, that's from an authoritative standpoint, but even reasonably, God does not expect the person to function outside of his capabilities. Now, a person can only learn a certain amount in a given day, in a given month, in a given year, and in the span of his life. More than what he learns, he is not held accountable for ignorance or certainly the lack of execution, because God does not expect a person to do that which he doesn't know about. The Talmud in Tractate Sabbath talks about this too. It depends on the person's level of ignorance, what he's culpable for. If, let's say, a person violated the Sabbath his whole life. So if his ignorance was about the existence of Sabbath, he only has to bring one sin offering for all of the violations, because his level of ignorance was so great, it was that it incorporated into it not knowing when the Sabbath would come about, or the various 39 Torah laws and then hundreds and hundreds of rabbinic laws that are attached to the Sabbath. So the person never knew about the Sabbath his entire life, and he broke all the laws, or so many of the laws his whole life, he only has to bring one sacrifice that atones for all of them, because that's commensurate with what he didn't know. If he knew about the Sabbath, he didn't know the day when it fell out, or he knew about the day, but he didn't know the certain laws, as his knowledge increases, so does his culpability. So you have two examples, one from Ethics of the Fathers, and one from the Talmud, and just reason dictates that as well, that even the Torah has a third source. It says that which is revealed are for us, but that which is hidden is to God. Meaning to say, if a person forgot that he sinned or he didn't know something, he is not held accountable. So in terms of what the rabbis made, on the one hand, each rabbi, when he was working in his area of Torah study, and he saw the sanction that God gave in Deuteronomy 17:11, it says, and according with the Torah that they teach you, meaning the rabbis, you must follow. So there you have the endorsement of God, the mandate by God to follow what the rabbis add on as protective devices. They can't add on to the laws, there's only 613, but they are mandated by God to set up fences, to make protective vehicles, so this way people don't err in the actual 613. So we have to follow their laws as well. And when each one of them saw a certain need for a fence, they saw that perhaps a person, the Torah law is not to build on a Sabbath. So they prohibited swimming in a lake because a person will get tired and string together some twigs or logs in order that he can float and relax a little bit, and that's actually construction. So they made a fence to protect the violation of building by making a rabbinic law not to swim. So you see the need for that, and each rabbi was correct in, you know, fulfilling his obligation as a rabbi to help people not violate. And there may be many, many out there. I don't think anybody's going to complete the Torah, but that's, again, the ethics of the Father says. It's not upon us to complete, nor is it upon us to abandon.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
You know, I think there's like a lot of people plenty of people keep all the rabbinic laws, and it's not, you just incorporate it into your lifestyle, and it's not so difficult. I mean, just like anything else, you know?
That you what? What was that again?
I mean, you know, plenty of people incorporate the rabbinic laws into their life, just like you know, anything else, and it's not so difficult, like... You know?
Well, I mean, Doug's point is well taken. It is voluminous. There is a tremendous amount. And it seems to be that how are you going to accomplish it? So there is a lot. We can't minimize that. I mean, it is, once you know certain things, and certainly when you understand the reasons behind it, it becomes second nature and it's appreciated by the mind. And through routine and habit, it's something which person is less apt to forget. So, certain things that we do on a regular basis become more part of our memory. There is a tremendous amount of detail. If we go through even just the 39 laws of the Sabbath, there's so much written. There's so many different angles. So there is a.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Rabbi, I just wanted to say that I agree with Naomi. It is like, in a sense, it is like everything else. If you can develop habits for different things in different areas, and keeping the laws and being observant is a habit we get used to. We know that at a certain time on Friday we have to stop everything because we have to get ready for Sabbath. Light candles, go to pray. We know basically that we've accepted, this is the thing, if people accept this kind of a thing, then it's easy. If people don't accept it, it'll never get done. It is like everything else. People will fight something they don't want to do, and they'll look for all the excuses not to do it because it's a burden, it's a restriction, it's everything. I come across it a lot in my everyday life with people, and it's very, very hard to explain to them that, okay, I do it now because I chose to do it, and there was a time that maybe I wasn't doing it the way I do it now, but it's something that grows with you. As we evolve as a person, our ways evolve with us, and our choices, and I don't know how to explain it. I'm trying to say it simply, but I think I'm making it more complicated.
All right, I understand.
See, I want to say I agree with what you're saying, and I always think about, like, if a person runs a business, so then he's got to do the Italian, and there's all these other things that he's got to do. And he gets used to it just part of the, you know, routine.
Exactly. You got to do what you got to do, basically. That's wrong with it. But it all comes down to the first step is I have made a choice. Now, this choice will take me here on the Sabbath, and I cannot go here on the Sabbath. Can I accept that? Yes, I can accept it because I see the benefit of keeping the Sabbath. I see the benefit of keeping the rules. I see the benefit. It's when they see the benefit themselves and they can't be pushed into it. Person has to make their own choice, but they have to be led down the road to see that the choice will be a benefit.
That's right. I mean, I think that's what Chris is actually writing on screen. He's saying that people are willing to subject themselves to amazing discipline and able to master all kinds of temporal occupations. Imagine what it takes to become a concert pianist, or a pro ball player, an academic, a business owner. Why can't Torah get at least as much dedication? Well, what I think the answer to that, Chris, is that where a person sees personal gain, subjective benefit, so then it'll be something, or especially if he's going to get fame and money, things that are very instinctually gratifying. So a person is born that way with those desires. So then it's not going to fight anything in terms of his personal, you know, lusts, his interests, his honor. But the same answer would apply why people would be rejecting Torah, because that Torah takes them away, in their mind, from enjoyment. So their categories of enjoyment are still infantile, and they're only going towards what they subjectively feel. But if the person would educate themselves, which takes time, you know, in terms of what the benefits of Torah are, then they would go after it with either you know, even greater you know, attention, and they would discipline themselves in that even more. It's a matter of education. Okay. Back to your questions. All right, Chris, I hope that answered yours. So are there any other questions that you have? I do have something prepared, so don't feel under pressure. I mean, I lied. I said during Sunday's class that I'm not going to prepare anything, but it ended up something took place last night, which prodded some thinking. So, but I'll wait until I want to hear out your questions, anything that's in your minds, you know, whatever topics you want to take up. And when you're ready, you could defer to me. Chaya in Florida, are you saying that you have something to ask? I just see you're writing something on screen. Let's give Chaya a chance just to type and see what her question is. Okay, and Chris also. Actually, so Chaya and Chris, why don't you write your questions on screen, and we'll take those up.
Rabbi?
One second. Okay. Yes, go ahead.
Is it okay for me to ask a question right now?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. I have a young friend, young woman, who I see occasionally, I speak to occasionally, and she has no interest in being observant in any way. And she claims that she's a spiritual person. She's very spiritual. She believes there's a God above. And she observes the non-Jewish holidays as well as the Jewish holidays. And she just is going with the flow. She feels that she's living in America and this is the way things are. And I tried to explain to her the difference between being observant, being religious, and being spiritual. Because she claims that she's just as religious as the person who is observant, because she's spiritual. But how can you delve into something like this and explain to the person that there is a difference? And in your opinion, how would you define it? Could you
Yeah, it's very simple.
Think about it a minute.
Yeah, it's very out. It's very open because you see that a person may feel a certain spiritual whatever. I don't know what they mean by that, but I assume it means some sort of religious emotion. But if they light up a cigarette on the Sabbath and they're Jewish, they're punished with death by the courts. So that's a law from God. And God says that feeling spiritual is insufficient, and so much so that even your life could be taken away if you violate the actual, you know, formulation of the laws. It's a very straightforward response. God does not say be spiritual. He actually even says that if a person hears all the curses in the Torah and he blesses himself in his heart, saying that I'll have peace because I'm following what my heart dictates. And you hear that today. People say all the time, just do what you feel in your heart. Well, God addressed that already in the Torah. And it says in the Torah that God will not forgive that person. That's a very severe thing, because typically tshuva, repentance, is something which can revert all sin. But a person like that, the Torah says God will not forgive that person. So we can go more, you know, more detail about that. But that's the statement, is that the basic rule is, don't think you know that you know. And how do you know what the truth is? Look at what God wrote. So God does not say spiritual is sufficient. Halacha is required. Strict adherence to halacha, to the Jewish system of law, is required. And imagine if everybody just did what was right in their own eyes. You know, the prophets and the judges, it talks about how man became corrupt because he just did what was right in his own eyes. So you have a complete destruction of the system. There's no one form of Torah anymore. So it destroys the system for future generations. So there's this damage to the self, and this damage to all future generations when people just take matters into their own hands and feel convinced by their egos that what they're doing is sufficient. God did not say that. God already knows what you're going to say about that, and he addressed it in the Torah. Am I right?
Very good. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Thank you so much. I don't know how it'll go by her, but
I think give it a shot.
I certainly bring it out in the open and try to explain it, and hopefully, even if she doesn't say I'm right or I'm wrong, maybe it'll penetrate at some point.
Very good.
Thank you, Rabbi.
And Chaya, you
also bringing to the top, like, you have to see that 9/11 is correct because you know, they were doing whatever felt good for them. I mean, they definitely thought that they, you know, felt spiritual and that they were following whatever, you know, they thought God wanted of them.
That's right. Yeah, and Christians also, and every other religion. That's a good point, Naomi. Thank you. All right.
You know, I didn't get that point, Rabbi.
She was mentioning that you have to indemnify the radicals that killed those 3,000 people on 9/11, because they were also just doing what was good in their heart. So once you say a person has...
Oh.
So, yeah, she's just embellishing the point.
Yes, very good. Okay, thank you, Naomi. Okay. Thank you, Rabbi. Okay.
All right, let me take up, as I mentioned before, Chaya and Chris both had questions. It's on screen now if anybody's on the talk live. Let me just read it out to everybody. Chaya, you're writing, I have a problem with arthritic knees and find it very difficult at times to walk even a block. My shul is a mile away. Why can't I take the bus that goes around my retirement community, take me to shul, and if I don't get to that, I don't have other Jews at my observer's level to share Shabbos with? Well, you can't violate the Sabbath. That's not something which trumps, you know, violating the Sabbath doesn't trump the observance. So to be around other people that are observant, first of all, is not an obligation. Sabbath is a great obligation. Again, that's punishable with death, so you cannot violate the Sabbath. You could arrange to stay with somebody's house for the Sabbath. And you should also know a woman doesn't have an obligation to attend the shul on Shabbos, right? So Torah study, in as much as her law is a command, but she doesn't have the obligation to hear the reading of the Torah. Although a woman has to pray, she can daven at home. So there's not the requirement to be with a group of 10. So there's no obligation there. I would suggest, if you want the company of others, to spend the Shabbos with them. So this way you can get out of the pain of walking, and you can also be with other people that are like-minded. All right. And Chris, your question is as follows. Many times, some physical punishment is recommended in Mishlei as a disciplinary measure in raising children. Is this meant to be taken literally or strictly metaphorically? It seems that society is adamantly opposed to physical punishment nowadays, but kids these days who are not punished physically are so unruly. What's your understanding? Well, I think it's going to go by, you know, a child-by-child basis. If a child keeps on hurting himself by sticking his hand in the fire and hasn't reached the age where it associates the fire with pain, it's better to slap the hand before it gets burnt in the fire. So that physical deterrent may be painful, but it's a lot less painful and short-lived than somebody's flesh being burnt. Just as an example, in terms of the cases you're talking about, you'll have to cite for me the actual verse in Mishlei where you're referring to. And yes, Mishlei is all metaphor. But there has to be also a plain sense of the word, too. So, for example, what we'll get into at the end of the class today, I will cite for you a few midrashim. I actually had I was invited to some friends for dinner last night, and their children had a few questions, and they didn't understand things that they were being taught in yeshiva. So I'll quote the two midrashim to you, and I'll show you how to approach it. But let me take your questions first. But if you want, Chris, type on screen the actual verse if you have it in front of you. Okay. And Chris and Chai, if you get any follow-up questions, just type it on screen, and I'll go back to the phone and see if anybody else has other questions.
Rabbi, in light of what you were just saying, here's another question I have. There are places, there are times that people are invited for the Passover Seder or for Sabbath, and even though they have to drive, the host will invite them and offer them a place to sleep, knowing maybe that they won't accept it, that it's not a good accommodation for them or whatever, and still invite them because they feel basically that if they don't see a Sabbath and they don't see a Seder, they won't ever have the interest in doing it. So they feel that in some way it's a good thing to invite them, and if they stay, they stay, and if they don't stay, they don't stop them from driving home, driving back.
Well, in general, I don't like to give rulings. I try to just discuss the philosophy behind things. I did hear conflicting responses to that law, whether that is permitted to do or not, meaning if you know that somebody is going to drive when you invite them, you're not really forcing them. I can see the angle that you're really not causing them. They have the opportunity to even come even before the Sabbath, and there is a gain that they're gaining by being there. If a person is definitely going to drive because of that, that's where the question really gets severe, because then you know for sure that you're hanging you're dangling a carrot in front of them, and it might be a violation of misleading. You're not allowed to mislead somebody and make them sin. So I can't answer the question conclusively, but maybe we could take it up another point. I did hear different rulings on that.
Okay, that will do. Thank you very much, Rabbi.
Okay, any other questions? All right, so maybe I'll just I'll talk a bit about the event that took place last night. And it's something which is very important because it can be, it can make or break a child's attachment to Torah and his respect for what's appealing to him. Let me just take up Chris's point. He just put something online. He's making the quote. He's going back to his question about punishment, whether it's literal, metaphoric. And he was citing where it says in Mishlei, in Proverbs, to quote, spare the rod, spoil the child. Another one, he says, he who loves a son rebukes him sometimes. And another quote, foolishness is bound up in the heart of a child, but the rod, meaning physical correction, will drive it far from him. And the fourth quote he has, do not withhold discipline from a child. If you punish him with the rod, he will not die. Punish him with the rod and save his soul from death. So again, this is, being that it's Mishlei, being that it's the book of Proverbs, so the sense of all these, and of course there's going to be a unique lesson in every verse. There's no repetition in Torah. The first one, spare the rod, spoil the child, means that if you withhold punishment, you're going to ruin him. This is proven from the case of King David's son, Adoniyahu. In one verse in the Torah, it says that Adoniyahu, King David's son, rebelled. He jumped and seized the kingdom ahead of King Solomon to be. And it also says in the verse that he was very handsome and that David never rebuked him. So in one verse, you have the idea that he rebelled, he was handsome, and David didn't rebuke him. The concept behind these three ideas being one verse is that they're all related, as Rabbi Chaya explained it. Anytime you have a single verse in the Torah, the concept of a singular verse means the ideas, all the ideas in the verse are linked together. There's a relationship. So what happened was because of the handsome appearance of Adoniyahu, so this is a tendency I see in many parents, that they don't want to cause a beautiful child to have a frown. They love the child's demeanor and the beauty of the face, and far be it from them to make any tears come out of their eyes. So they never rebuke them. The child ends up never learning rebuke and never learns that there's something that he cannot do or she cannot do. And this explains why in the same verse it says that Adoniyahu rebelled, because he never learned rebuke. So that's the first statement that you quoted. If you spare the rod, if you don't use discipline, you'll ruin the child. That means that if the rebuke is not there, then you'll never teach the child the difference between what is good and what is evil. That's what it means. That's the ruin that will come. Then another statement says, he who loves his son rebukes him sometimes. So there, what King Solomon is pitting up one against the other is that typically a person would think if you love your son, you always treat him in a positive fashion. But he's telling you, no, the real love that you have is not a love that's trying to keep a very pleasant relationship with him. Love, real love, true love of a son is going to be to look for the good for him. And that demands that the son is going to be rebuked. The next quote, foolishness is bound up in the heart of the child, but the rod of correction will drive it far from him. So this is telling you that another idea, that inherently a child has incorrect thoughts. And also that explanation is not always the right response, because a child may not be on the level to listen, to hear it. So that's why the rod of correction, something which you use to hit, a rod is used to hit. So he doesn't necessarily mean that you have to physically hit the child, but it means that taking on the role of correcting the child is necessary, and it'll drive the foolishness from him. Meaning to say that sometimes you just have to grab the child's hand before he runs out into the traffic, because there's foolishness. He doesn't know about the fact that he has to look both ways yet. So, and explaining it to a two-year-old or a three-year-old may still be too soon. So therefore, just a physical demonstration, it may need some time that you associate it with pain. But, I mean, that is a last resort. And the last one is addressing the fear of the parent, where it says, quote, do not withhold discipline from a child. If you punish him with the rod, he will not die. Punish him with the rod and save his soul from death. So here there's a thought that parents have that physical punishment is, any type of pain is not good. Any type of pain must be avoided. So what does King Solomon say? He says, don't withhold the discipline from a child. If you punish him with physical punishment, he's not going to die. Meaning, don't look at it as being such a severe thing. But, and he says the last part of the verse, you punish him with a rod, that's when you'll save him from death. I mean, if you're truly worried about death of the child, so then there's two types of death that he's addressing. The first, when he says that if you punish him with a rod, he will not die, that means physical death. The second part of the verse where he says, punish him with the rod and save his soul from death, now he's talking about eternal death. I mean, if you allow a child to sin and you don't correct him, then he's going to live a life against Torah, and then he will not have a soul in the next world. He won't have any infinite existence that is promised to all of us. And so what King Solomon is trying to focus in on is the overvaluation, the overestimation of the physical life and trying to avoid inflicting any pain because people value the physical life more. So what he's trying to do over here is pit up the physical pain with the eternal pain and the physical good to the eternal good. And the rabbis speak about this too. They talk about this, that a person should measure the benefits he gets from an instantaneous pleasure versus the eternal punishment he can get from it, versus the temporal pain a person can get from, let's say, fasting, and compare that to the eternal reward he can get from that if he corrects his soul by fasting. So here, too, is the same concept. So each verse is teaching a unique and a beautiful idea that you have to look at the words to see. So I hope that it helps out, Chris. Okay.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Rabbi, may I say something?
Yes.
Yeah, in reference to the question that Chris had, if bearing the rod can hurt the child, sometimes when we don't have to necessarily punish them by punish them and hurting them. My mother, blessed memory, had taught me that when I had my children, in order to teach the children, you don't have to hit them, but you can explain to them and show them when you quit. And I had a problem with one of my children. He insisted on going to the stove continually. He wanted to. He would tease me with it. He was touching the stove. And in order to tell him hot, hot, to go away, finally, when I took him to the stove, I brought him myself. And I brought him with his hand as close as I could while he started to feel the heat before actually touching any part of the stove. He would feel the heat. I would bring his hand closer and closer until he would feel the heat stronger and stronger until he pulled his hand away. And that's how he learned. And I had to take the time to do that a few times, and he would test me because this is what it is. And I remember that it wasn't a punishment, but I had to discipline, and the discipline is so important for the children as well as for ourselves.
Rabbi King Solomon,
we have to know what is okay and what is not okay, and we have to instill discipline in the child within us when we are trying to learn, when we are trying to observe, in all ways.
That may be true. That may be true, but we can't ignore King Solomon's words. He says clearly, if you punish him with the rod, he will not die. So clearly he's saying that's a literal case. So there are times when physical measures are necessary. So we have to accept what he's saying as being accurate, and it makes sense to me because there are times where this type of procedure that you took is not going to apply to a certain type of a child. Each parent has to determine
whether that is
going to be applicable.
Oh, that's a bit. Heaven forbid, I was not saying that he was wrong.
Okay.
By no means. I'm just saying that in the little things that mothers go through with their little children, they could start at that point, or they could start to learn that when the mother or the father speaks, that they should acknowledge, and then it's easier as they get older.
Okay, this is true.
Children then understand the parents' words, what no means. Sometimes children don't know what no means, and they don't realize they can trust the parents saying no is for their benefit, and that's a small way of bringing them closer to understanding that a parent is not trying to hurt them, but that they could be trusted and they could be listened to. That's all I meant.
Okay, thank you.
I didn't mean to make a misunderstanding there.
Thank you.
Thank you for correcting me, Rabbi. Thank you.
I think it's also very important to understand the sensitivity of the child and make the punishment at the same level. If you have a very sensitive child who gets it really quickly, then you don't need to have the punishment as severe as a very strong-willed child.
Correct.
One of the other things that I was always curious about, when they talk about
taming wild horses, they talk about breaking the spirit. And I also wondered what that meant. I mean, if you break the spirit of a child, sometimes that can be devastating. And I just wondered if there's any association in that with people.
No. I mean, the you know, busting a bronco is a different thing altogether than what you're doing in terms of training a child. You don't want to break a child's spirit. You want to redirect it.
That's a good point.
Now, Chris, you're writing, okay, you believe that Hashem punishes his children out of chesed. That's right. God punishes those who follow him. That's what actually King Solomon says. Those who God loves, he rebukes, because he knows that, I mean, if God loves somebody, that's because that person loves God, and he's trying to follow his way. So God will then, so to speak, take his time to send him corrective measures. He knew that Abraham would listen, and God said, leave the land that you're in, because this would help out Abraham in terms of his teaching and his own profession. And Chris, you go on to write, but the Islam says, if Hashem were your father, he would not punish you. All right, well, we know Islam is very corrupt. I mean, the Islamic doctrine, the Quran, actually it takes a position, if you can't beat them, not join them, but take responsibility for them. What do I mean? The Quran, the writers realized that everything in the Torah is true, was unanimously accepted. It could not be that the historical fact, the miracles, all the events that took place would be accepted by a nation of millions if somebody really just lied to a group of people. A group of people would not believe Moses if the things really didn't take place. That's why Moses repeats to them, don't forget what your eyes saw. So it's very important that everything is based on what we test in reality, what we see in reality. And the Quran, the Islamic people, they recognize that. So what was their approach in order to start the religion? They took responsibility, and they write in the Quran that we gave Moses to the Jews and we gave Jesus to the Christians. So they take a whole different strategy, and their ideas are very corrupt and very vicious. So it's true what you write, that their ideas are just completely off kilter. And maybe this concept was to help warp the Islamic mind. Could be. Okay. All right, but on that point, there is, unless there's any other questions, I don't want to start unless people have answered all your questions the best they can. All right, so let me tell you what took place yesterday, which I mentioned earlier. So I was invited to some friends, have some dinner, haven't seen them in a while, and before we sat down, so they have a couple of sons, and two of them had some questions. So one question they had was, why was, and they're talking about last week's and this week's Torah readings. And one, the older son, Zach, he wanted to know, because I guess this is a question that his rabbi gave him, and maybe it was a homework assignment, and he was talking about the story when Jacob left because Esav, his brother, was going to kill him because he stole the birthright. So his parents told him to leave and to go to Paddan Aram and take one of the daughters of his mother's brother, meaning take one of his cousins as a wife. So he gets to the well, which is near where he's supposed to go, and he asks about if they know of Laban, and they said, yes, we know Laban, and here comes his daughter Rachel right now. So it says that he saw Rachel coming with the sheep of his the brother's mother, and he I'll read it to you. It says, let's see. Right, and it was a when, this is in Genesis 29:10, and it was a when Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of Laban, the brother of his mother, and the sheep of Laban, the brother of his mother, that Jacob drew close, and he rolled off the stones from under the mouth of the well, and he watered the flock of Laban, the brother of his mother. The next verse, 29:11, and Jacob kissed Rachel, and he lifted up his voice, and he cried. And then Jacob told, and the final verse in this series is, and Jacob told to Rachel that he was the brother of his father, meaning her cousin, and that Rivka, that he was the son of Rivka, Rebecca. And she ran and she told her father. Okay, so the question was why he cried. Did Jacob lift up his voice? He kissed Rachel and then he lifted up his voice and he cried. So this is the question that was given to him. So that was one question. Let's take the more difficult one first, though, which was not Zach's question, but it was... Actually, Warren, this is not a long answer, so why don't we just address it. The Torah writes in a way where we talked about this last week, where there's many clues given to the answer. And as a person studies for years and decades, they start getting very sensitive to it, and they could very quickly start to see where the answer is going to emerge from. And if you see the verse we read first, it says that that Jacob saw, and it wasn't when Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of Laban, the brother of his mother, and the sheep of Laban, the brother of his mother. And Jacob drew close. He rolled off the stones from the mouth of the well. That's how they used to protect their wells back then. They'd put a great big stone on it. So not one individual couldn't roll it off. They'd need to wait for all the shepherds to gather together. But Jacob was very, very healthy, very strong, so he was able to do it alone. But it says again at the end of the verse that he rolled off the stone from the mouth of the well, and he wore the sheep of Laban, the brother of his mother. So you see in that verse, it says the brother of his mother three times. Completely unnecessary. Once you know it once, you don't need to have it repeated, unless the Torah is trying to draw your attention to something. Immediately after that, it says that Jacob had kissed Rachel, and he lifted up his voice and he cried, and then he told Rachel that he was her cousin, that he was the brother of his father, really being the son of Rivka. So it opens and concludes with this concept of whose relatives are. If you look earlier in last week's parsha, so Isaac commands Jacob after they find out the Esav is considering to kill him because he stole the birthright. He tells Jacob in Genesis 28:2, he says, "Go and take from the daughters of Laban, the brother of your mother. Go and take as a wife from the daughters of Laban, the brother of your mother." So there's the first time we see that. Now we read it again here, it echoes back to there. And then we can now put the pieces of the puzzle together why he was crying. So there are different midrashim, different allegories given, but you see clearly that he was told by his father a certain command, and he listened to the command, and he was going to follow it. And now he sees this first woman that he meets is the daughter of Laban, the brother of his mother. So what is the cry? The cry really means that he sees how God is working the plan after him. So right from the verses, you can get to the answer. So this is what I'm planning on telling Zach, that just to learn how to see the questions and the answers right in the verses. Of course, the midrash and the allegories give other ideas that are true. Okay, so that was one question. But the real crux of why I wanted to bring this up is that there's a problem that there is a literal teaching of these allegories and metaphors that are really hurting the minds of children. And this is where Jonah, the youngest son, his question comes in. And he asks as follows. And it was based on two allegories. And of course, we know an allegory is something which is making a concrete description, which didn't really take place in reality, but it's a formulation, a story that's written by the rabbis in order to indicate an idea, a true idea, a philosophical idea, a religious idea. So what was he quoting to me? He says to me like this. There were two midrashim. He says, one midrash says that when you're in the belly of your mother, as he put it, so then you learn with an angel all the Torah. And then when you leave, an angel touches you on your lip, and you forget it all. Okay, so that's one allegory. But then he says, so my Rebbe, my teacher, said to me that when Rivka was pregnant and had, when Rebecca was pregnant and she had Esav and Jacob inside her stomach, so anytime she passed by a house of Torah study of Shem, who was the son of Noah, so then Jacob wanted to get out and study. And whenever Rebecca would pass by, when she was still pregnant, when she passed by a house of idolatry, Esav wanted her run out. And this is going on the verse in the Torah where it says that the children like were tumultuous inside of her stomach. So the rabbis write an allegory. And they say, what does it mean they're tumultuous? It means to say that whenever she passed by the Torah study house, that Jacob wanted to get out of her stomach. And when she passed by the house of idolatry, so Esav wanted to get out of her stomach. So the problem is apparent. As adults, we see that it's an impossibility. But he was not taught this. He was actually taught by his teacher that this is really what took place. So based on the fact that he was taught these things literal, he asked me, well, why would the guy who's inside his mother's stomach, if he's studying with an angel, why would he want to go out and learn in school in a yeshiva? All right, does everybody see this question? Based on the fact that he was taught these two allegories as literal, so now it presented a real problem in his mind. Not to mention the fact that he was probably thinking, well, how can you see outside of my mother's stomach anyway? It's dark in there. How would he know what's going on? So this is a major problem. That the teachers today are really products of the same crime, where they were being taught literal, and they were not taught to analyze, and they accept these things. Now, there's a principle here that can help out both the teacher and the student in this case, and that is if we look exactly at reality what God gave us. So what God gave us, number one, are the physical senses. Why did he give us physical senses? Does he want me to look at a dark night and assume that I'm incorrect and it's really daylight and I can go out and drive without my lights on? No. This would be a certain suicide. The same thing in terms of if I were to say to myself, that's really not a piece of fruit in front of me. A person's starving, and he thinks the piece of fruit is really a rock. So he says, I'm not going to eat it. And he starves himself to death because he says, what I'm seeing is not real. No, it's just the opposite. God gave us the senses in order that we know accurately what is occurring in the universe, whether it's in the cosmos or whether it's on our kitchen table and everywhere in between. So the senses, number one, are given to us as a gift that we have an accurate assessment as to what's real. By that token, we are supposed to reject what is false. Right? Meaning to say, the acceptance of truth at the same time mutually excludes that it's false. Everybody understand what that means? That means to say that by the fact that I determine that this is really a fruit, I also know that it's nothing other but than a fruit. I can also reject it as being a rock. And because of that thinking, I can now nourish myself because I can relate to reality properly. So that's one thing that God gave us, the senses. The other thing he gave us is reason. Meaning now that I know that is a fruit, then there's some way I can determine how I interact with it. How do I accept it? What are my moves? What are my steps that I make from this point? If I determine I'm hungry and it's not food that I have in front of me, I have to determine that I cannot consume it. I'll break my teeth on it. It's a rock. Okay. So, but this my friend's son, Jonah, so he didn't know which way to go. He was young. Maybe 7 or 8, he still is crippled by the undue respect he gives to anything a teacher says must be correct. So I tried to say that to him, and he still felt, he heard what I said, and I wasn't going to hold it back because I saw that was the problem he had. His eyebrows shot up to the sky when I said your teacher was making a mistake. like, what? My teacher? My Rebbe? So, I saw that was really the underpinnings. I was concerned, but we had to get to the core of this whole concept of that the medrash, the allegory, is something which the rabbis wrote as a means of conveying ideas. But the reason why they wrote this way, you can answer the question, well, why not just write the idea truthfully? Just give a literal explanation. Why did they write an allegory, a metaphor, and riddles, riddles and poetic expression that King Solomon says this in the beginning of Proverbs. He says that the rabbis wrote this way in order to give the simple-minded a sharper thinking, to give them acumen, and to give more knowledge to the young. That's what he writes right in the beginning of Proverbs. See, evidently his teacher is not following what our prophets teach, that the rabbis do speak in riddle. Maimonides' son, Abraham, wrote an introduction to a book called Ein Yaakov. I think it was written in the 1600s. It was a compilation by this one rabbi, a great work, where he culled from the Talmud all of the Agadic stories, all of the allegory parts, because the Talmud is made up of two parts, the Jewish law, the analysis of the law, and then there's many stories that are in there as well. So he pulled out all the stories, created this work called Ein Yaakov, and it's in English. It's fantastic. And these are all, again, allegories. And Maimonides' son wrote an introduction talking about how these things are not to be taken literal. So the principle that I hope I can convey to his son Jonah is that you see that it's God's will that you use reality as your barometer for what's true or not. So now let's apply it to your case. So what was this case that you learned? There were two questions that he had. Are you learning with an angel in your mother's stomach before you're born? And did Jacob really... They weren't in question form. He was just confused because he took them literally. But these really are what the questions that hopefully we'll be able to show to him. And the second one was that, can Jacob or Esau really know what is going on outside of their mother as she passes by either a house of idolatry or a house of Torah study? So the first step in a case like this is to really show the youngster that the way you know things are true. How do you do it normally? So you show him that you have senses, you can taste things, you can feel things, and you get him to agree with you. You get him to see that he does detect reality and he is convinced by what it is, by his senses. Then you tell him that what do you do with it? Do you eat this or do you not eat that? Do you build with this or do you not build with that? And again, he'll be able to answer you very easily. Once you have him admit that, and that you take his words and you say, you see, now you understand that you trust your sensations, you trust what you see, what you hear. You know, use the words that he can understand. And the second thing is that he knows that he can trust his thinking to know what to do with it. You ask him, what do you do with an apple? Do you eat it or do you build a house with it? So he'll think it's a silly question. He'll be very convinced. So now you use that conviction that you got him to express. Now you say, now let's go to what you learned in school. So it's dark inside your mother's belly when you're inside there. And even if after you're born, you look at people that are born, little babies that are born, they can't read, they can't talk. Do you think that a baby knows where it is? So he'll again agree no. So you tell him, well, if a baby doesn't know where it is after it's born, so when it was younger, still inside its mother, do you think it knew where it was? Certainly its eyes are closed. Certainly there's no window on his mother's stomach that he could look out of. So now you get him to start realizing and seeing that this is, you don't ignore the area of Torah study from applying reason and applying your senses. See, this is really where the dichotomy is. People feel in every other area of life you can use your senses and you can use reason. When it comes to religion, no, it's blind. It's faith. But this is really the steps, I think, that are necessary in order to show the child that just like you're convinced about how things are real and true in the physical world, whether you build with apples or you build with nails and wood, whether you're going to eat a rock or whether you're going to take a rock and make a pathway in front of your house to walk on. So then you show me. You apply the same thing in terms of the rabbis. Then you can get them to see that they really mean something else. They speak in riddles. So once he can get him to cross that line, then again, there's always going to be the issue of courage, you know, speaking against, or arguing with your teacher. That's something which may just take maturity to develop. But an approach to that, you can even show the child and open a Gemara, open a Talmud, and show him, look, there's two rabbis in the Talmud that are arguing with each other, and they can't both be right. Either this piece of meat is kosher, or this piece of meat is not kosher. Right? They both admit that they disagree with the other rabbi. So you see, you know, you could tell your son, your student, your daughter, you could say, you see, they didn't just accept, they used their minds, they thought, and when they didn't agree with anybody, somebody could put their mute on, there's a lot of static coming. So unless you're speaking, just put the mute button on. So, the
Rabbi.
Yes. Let me just.
Rabbi, that's an excellent thing to show because.
Well, let me just finish the point. I'll come to you in a second. Hello.
Yes, one of the basic things when boys go to yeshiva is the basic thing is they should learn how to trust their own mind to ask questions, not to be afraid to ask questions. Just as there was disagreements between rabbis and it shows it very clearly in the Gemara, they should be able to feel free to ask the rabbis, the teachers, a question if something doesn't make sense to them, not to blindly accept everything. Just like when Fiona said that if the angels pressed on the mouth of Yaakov, then how did he still know Torah after that? Or how Darryl was just saying that he wanted to make a point and ask a question. Is it possible that when there was the struggle in Rivka, that when they passed, when she passed the yeshiva, that Yaakov wanted to go out to learn? If he already learned what the angel taught him, is it possible, Darryl was saying, that Yaakov wanted to go out because he knew, first of all, he was Yaakov and he had Nevuah, he had prophecy, but he knew without seeing through a window, so to speak, that they were the yeshiva, that they were passing, he sensed it. And maybe he didn't want to go out to learn, but maybe he wanted to go out to teach. Is it possible that could come into play?
No, that's not what it says. But I'll answer it. I'll finish up and you'll see the answer.
Okay, thank you.
So
I wanted to ask you a question. Could it mean that the two babies that Esau was born like already a Rasha? From his...
No.
That he was born? I mean, is that possible?
No, that's impossible. God gives free will to everybody. We'll have to answer it. Well, you're right. We have to answer what does it mean that even in the womb... that they had a different, it seems like they wanted to do two different things. But we'll finish it up, and then hopefully they'll answer your question, okay? All right. And just to Tina, the name of the book is Ein Yaakov. I believe it's spelled E-I-N, and then Y-A-A-K-O-V. Ein Yaakov is the name of the book. Okay. All right, so... in terms of applying this now to this youngster, to my friend's son, so once you show him that he trusts and he's convinced in his senses, and he's convinced, number two, in his ability to know what to do, meaning his thinking, so then you have to, that's the bridge across. Of course, there's going to be the maturity issue of, you know, opposing your teacher, but that, again, has to be nurtured. But the way to get around that, as I'm saying, is you show him how even great thinkers, they never just accepted anybody. I mean, you have stories like this throughout. The Torah says that Aaron, who was the lesser of the two brothers, him and Moses, that he disagreed with Moses, and he ended up being right. And Moses even said that he was right about something. So there's nothing wrong with disagreeing with somebody much greater than you, because nobody has a monopoly on truth except for God. And the Talmud also talks about it and says, was one person, one rabbi said, he disagreed with a point, and he said, I wouldn't agree with it. I wouldn't hear it, even if Joshua, the son of Nun, said it. Meaning, the first disciple, the first leader, subsequent to Moses. He said, it doesn't matter how great the person is. So these are the lessons you have to teach the child. So in terms of finally explaining what these things mean, that's really, of course, what, you know, the son Jonah would be interested in. Well, what does it really mean? But it's important to, along the path of explanation, is to try to isolate what he's battling with and show him and bring it out in the open. Because then he can confront that too, and then he can deal with it. But if he hasn't realized that he has a fear of opposing his teacher, and it's really just an emotion that's controlling him, there's no way to really work with that. So that has to be brought out to him. So, and the answer is really the simple part of the whole process. Meaning going through the steps of getting him to utilize his conviction in how you determine what's true, meaning what your senses tell you, and then how do you apply that with reason, to get him to use that and to apply that to his Torah study, that's really the bridge to be crossed. So then we ask him, if that's true, that we only know what our senses tell us and what our mind can reason about those things, does it make sense to you? Make it a question if it works better. Does it make sense to you that the baby, who can't even know where he's at as soon as he's born, so when he's younger, inside the mother months earlier, can he know that his mother's passing by a yeshiva? So he'll grapple with it, and you'll say, no, it really means something else. And use some examples of riddles, too. Like what I did with them last night, as I said, as an example, I said, I'm so hungry, I can eat a horse. Now, I said to them, do you think I could really fit a horse inside my stomach? So, of course, they said no. So I said, I'm just exaggerating. I'm saying that's one way that the rabbis also talk about. That's what King Solomon said. He said the rabbis speak in riddles, exaggeration, and allegory. They use this in order to get you to think and get your mind excited. And then you think into it. And what I'm trying to say is that just like a horse is so big, I've got a big appetite. So they understood. Again, so you use things. A metaphor is when you borrow something from the repertoire or the reservoir of knowledge that the child already has, something which he's already familiar with. You use that to make your point. Like for another example, the thing with the angel learning inside. So what I'm going to explain to him is that an angel has really, the way I explain it to him is two parts. Really, an angel is one thing and it governs natural law. So if God instructs an angel to do something, so let's take, for example, like King David said, God makes the wind his angels, and the fire, and a blazing fire, he makes into his servants. So that's in Psalms, he says that. So what does it mean? He makes the flaming fire as his servants. That means a fire exists as part of natural law, but he could make it into a servant if he controls the law and guides it in a certain way to be a pillar of fire in front of the Jews as they travel through the Red Sea. Now, what was just normally the physical combustion now becomes an angel. The real Hebrew word for angel is malach. Malach is from the same word as malacha, which means work, to achieve an activity, to perform an act. So when God uses a physical force to perform an act, it's now doing his malacha, or malach. And malach is just translated as angel or agent. So you can look at an angel as an agent of God. But really, there are laws that we don't see, that are not physical, that control the physical world. Okay, for example, a good example would be gravity. So we don't see gravity. We see the effects of gravity. We see that things are resting on the earth, and if things are lifted up, they fall back down. So we're looking at the effects of gravity, the physical expression of it. But there's actually a law. There's a metaphysical law. There is a whole metaphysical world that controls the physical. So that is really what, when we talk about agents, that God is utilizing, he is harnessing those laws to change, or he suspends a physical law, so this way the waters will pile up like walls when the Jews travel through the Red Sea. So I explained to him, it's like a puppet. I drew on his reservoir of knowledge. He knows what a puppet is. There's this little thing made of wood that has a hand, face, and body, arms and legs, and there's strings attached to those limbs that go up to two pieces of wood. And a person can move the pieces of wood, and it makes the puppet move. But the puppet can't move by itself. There has to be something above which is controlling the puppet. So I said the same thing works with a malach. A malach means there's a certain force that exists in heaven. I just use the word heaven, meaning, and those things control the physical world. So, for example, God destroyed Sodom and Amorah, so the Torah says that he sent angels to do it. So that means that God moves, so to speak, those strings in heaven, which have an effect on how the physical forces work on earth. So I said to him, now, when you're in your mother's stomach, and the rabbis say that you're learning with an angel, what that could mean, very simply, is that there is something that there is a force already, like an ability, I called it. There's an ability that you already have even before you're born, that you can choose the life of Torah. So I said to him, why is this necessary for us to know? So the way the rabbis construct it, and they say that when you're in the womb, you learn the whole Torah. When you leave, the angel touches you and you forget it. Meaning to say that in the very formation of the embryo, the person, the human being, all the tools are there. And I'll give you an example of just one tool, which is not something learnt. It's something which is actually hard-coded on the human being. And that's called comparison. And I'll give you an example that comparison is not something that's learned. You see a child, when a stranger comes and picks him up, he starts crying. Because the mind is constantly comparing from the time we're born to the time we die. It compares what we see, what we hear. As soon as a child sees a face that he compares to what he knows his parents look like, and it doesn't match, he cries. That's not a learned thing. A child would do that. Even in terms of smell, a child knows what the parents smell like. They did studies, and that's something which can calm the child down. So you see that those are the things that they're referring to that's learned already. Those tools of knowledge that are not learned but are hard-coded, just like the heart doesn't have to learn how to pump. The intellect of a person doesn't have to learn how to compare. It automatically compares. It sees two objects, one's red and one is green. It automatically knows they are not similar. See, it knows the idea of similarity too. It knows the idea of equality too. So all the tools that are necessary to learn distinction and comparison, that is something which is part of how we're created. It is not learned. Now, this will be a harder exercise to explain to an 8-year-old, but we'll attempt it. But the idea is to show him that there are riddles, that there are these different ways that the rabbis spoke. But now we get to the question. So why did the rabbis just say things openly? So that's exactly what King Solomon said in the beginning, the first chapter of Proverbs, in order to sharpen the mind of the simpletons. Because with the mind exercising, it's just like a muscle. The more you use it, the more it strengthens. All right, so I'm going to use a muscle to explain exactly what he's talking about in the book. I'm using a metaphor to talk about the book of metaphors, because that's something which will help us to understand how it works too, that there are numerous similarities between the body and even the physical world. I mean, King Solomon says to the lazy person, go look at the ant and see how it collects in the winter, and it has whatever it takes care of. Meaning to say, King Solomon wants a lazy person to break out of the laziness. So what does he use? He uses the smallest insect to say, if this little thing can provide for itself, you certainly can. So he uses an a fortiori argument from the minor to the greater. But he uses a metaphor, because that's part of the reservoir of knowledge that the person already knows, and he'll agree with. So if you'll agree with that, you must agree with the principle that he's trying to bring out. So this is the approach in terms of giving the child the understanding of that these are to be taken as metaphors, and you show them how the rabbis always spoken, that the whole book, that one of the greatest prophets, King Solomon, wrote, one of the wisest men ever to live, and he wrote in riddles, because when you think about it, your mind starts to excel, and then you could probe deeper, and you can see greater knowledge. So I think it's a very important thing that this is something that we share with others, that it's, because when the children are, unfortunately, they're being taught these high-level allegories before they're even 10 years old. So if you're going to teach them, you have to teach them the fact that there is a great amount of Torah which is written in a riddle form, and metaphor, and allegory. Okay, let me stop here and see if there's any questions or comments. All right, we're okay?
Rabbi?
Yes.
I just want to cite a certain incident that I heard about years ago when a child was confused in yeshiva, and he reprimanded, didn't make sense, something did not make sense to him, and the rabbi took a ruler, slapped him on his hand with the ruler, and said, "Don't question me." Now, I don't know if that exists anymore today. This happened maybe 30 years ago. Can that be why a child might be afraid to question a rabbi, or maybe he's told not to question by his parents?
Of course, that'll scare the heck out of him.
Authority.
That'll certainly deter him, of course.
Yeah. So I think that the most important thing is that the parent should make sure that the child, children, whatever the case may be, are in hands of somebody who is teaching them in a good way, in a kind way, in an open way, so that they can, just the way you were speaking about the two young boys that you were with last night, that you were trying to explain openly, lovingly, to use your mind and, you know, "I'm so hungry I could eat a horse." That's a beautiful way of saying, did I mean that? It's just an expression, but it has no real meaning. And this is how sometimes people say things, and children who are so innocent and accepting will be misled, go down the wrong path, and take words as truth when they may be apprehensive to ask questions or to defy the rabbi, for instance.
Yeah, I suggest that to these parents. I suggested to these parents that homeschooling should be an option. If they can't get a good teacher in the school, and they is much better off. Either that, or they keep on reinforcing them with the correct notion that to train the children to go back and to be able to say they disagree. And I think they'll do well. They have good parents. So, okay. All right. Did that answer your question?
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Sure, my pleasure. All right. Any other questions or comments?
Hey, Yeshua, I wanted to ask a question.
Okay, Yeshua, go ahead. I didn't hear that. Why was Asa?
I'm wondering why Asa was a
response. Oh, okay.
Why after that he was a rasha, and because both of his parents were tzaddikim, so how can he have turned out to be a rasha?
Okay, I'm very glad, Yeshua, that you asked that, because that reminds me of something I forgot to say. So we were talking about how when Rivka passed by a house of idolatry, you know, a place of avodah zarah, so Asa wanted to get out, and when Rivka passed by Yeshiva, so Yaakov wanted to get out. So does that mean that they were determined that they had to be good or they had to be bad without any free will? No, it doesn't mean that. It means that they had tendencies, that God can create a person as he wishes, and he creates certain person, you know, certain people with certain tendencies. And since God knows the future, so he may make a person like a Moshe Rabbeinu, like Moses, and he'll give him a great mind, that he'll make him very, very smart because he knows that this person will use it. And he won't give that maybe to somebody who's not going to use it right. But God gave the abilities of Esav to be very, very, he had very strong passions, and that he could have used for the good. And Jacob, God gave, he gave him a very calm passion because he knew that he used that for the good. Why God does that we don't know. We could never understand why God does certain things. But God did not make Esav a rasha, and God did not make Yaakov, he didn't make Jacob, you know, a righteous person, a tzaddik. He gave them different abilities, and that's up to God what abilities he gives to each person. So Asaph decided for himself, because everybody has his own way he could choose for himself. You know what that means, Yeshua? That when you can choose to do what you want. If mommy tells you that you have to wait to do something, so you can choose to wait, or you can choose not to wait. It's up to you. Everything you do in your life is up to you. So Asaph also, he had the ability, if he wanted to learn from his grandfather Abraham, or if he wanted to learn from his father Yitzchak, he could have done that. He could have done that, and he could have used all his power to sit and learn. Or maybe if he was very, very
able to learn Torah by himself, right? Because Aaron, when Aaron would do things, he would completely do it, right?
When Asaph was what?
When Asaph did things, he would do them completely. So if he studied Torah, he was going completely, and he'd become it home. So how come?
Well, he chose. He did not want to study Torah, because everybody has that choice. And Esav just, he made the wrong choice. So just because your father is a big Talmud Chacham, it doesn't mean that you're going to be that way. Hashem gives everybody, God gives everybody free choice. God says, you decide. I want you to make your own decision. So that's why Esav, there was nothing forcing him to do it. Do you understand what I'm saying? He decided himself. So the reason why Esav became a wicked person, even though his father was a tzaddik, was a righteous person, it was because Esav made a bad decision.
I have another question. Like, what person is a better tzaddik? A person who is a tzaddik, but who's like rushing and rushing and rushing. He tries not to waste like a second. He moves up so fast. The person who's a tzaddik and takes his time. Like the other person, for example, he wants to be a tzaddik, but he's like rushing. And trying to do stuff as fast as he could. Because he always wants to get on to the next thing. But there's another person that's a tzaddik and they take it wisely. But that one's a very tzaddik in his need.
Okay, well, I don't think... I don't think... I don't think either one.
Yes, I think so.
What is he finished?
Yeah.
Okay.
Asking like which is a better tzaddik.
Right. I understand the question. He said it very well, Joshua.
No.
Yeshua, you asked the question very well.
He's doing stuff like rushing, and another person that he's not doing stuff completely. He's just doing stuff because he's so calm. And to go on to the next thing, but a person who's doing stuff that's using his mind and in the right way.
Oh, I see. I see you're asking now. Yes.
There's somebody who does more, somebody who does less, but does things correctly.
No, somebody that does.
So the answer is, of course, that if you're rushing to do things and you don't do it well, so even though you do more, it doesn't mean you're a better tzaddik. Really, the second person you're talking about, the person that does it slower and he does it the right way, and he understands, and he stops to learn, why am I doing this? And he makes sure he does it right. Let's say a person, we'll take an example. Let's say a person is davening in the morning, and he's praying to Hashem. So one person does it fast, fast, fast. He just wants to get finished. But the other person does it slow, and he thinks about what he's saying. So you tell me, who's going to be a better person?
The person that does it slow, right?
Right. Why? Why is he better? You tell me, Yeshua, why is the person that does it slow, why is he better?
When you do something like so fast, it doesn't really give a point of doing it.
Forgetting.
Yeah, but when you do something like, let's say you have a test in school, you have to write stuff that's good. There's one guy who's just writing like the B's and stuff and all that.
Yeah.
And he's not thinking. He's just writing it because he wants to move on to the next subject.
Right, very good. So, but let's think about the reason behind it. Now, you're correct. You said the right thing. But now let's understand. So what is it that makes it better when you do it slower?
I know why. When you do it so fast, it's good if you could like finish it fast and do it the complete way, but when you finish it, you think about what you're doing, you do it right, better.
Very good. That's the answer. The answer is that when you do it slower, you could think about what you're doing, and now you understand, you're understanding why you're doing it. And this teaches us a new thing. Your question teaches us a new thing. It teaches us that the important thing, and I was just reading this in a book by a very, very smart man. There's a book called Duties of the Heart. And in this book, the rabbi says that if a person does a mitzvah, and he just does it and he doesn't understand why he's doing it, he shouldn't do it. He also says if a person's going to pray to Hashem and he's going to daven, and he's going to pray, and he's just gonna, and he's not, his mind can't really concentrate, so he says that person should not pray, because then you're not thinking about what you're doing. So this teaches us that in order to do a mitzvah properly, we have to understand why we're doing it. We have to agree with our minds. So what you're saying is that you have to think about it, and when you think about what you're doing, sometimes it takes a little bit longer than if you just do it fast. So that's why the purpose of all the mitzvahs that Hashem gave us, of all the commands that God gave us, the purpose is that we see a new idea with each one. So it's true we have to shake a lulav and an esrog. It's true that we have to build a sukkah. It's true that we have to wear a tzitzis and a kippah. But what's more important is not the action, but it's the understanding of why we do it. Because when we understand why we do it, then we're increasing in our love for Hashem. We're increasing in our appreciation. We appreciate the Torah even more. And this is really the whole reason why Hashem made us, is that we should increase, we should grow. Our love of the Torah and of Hashem should grow, but it could only grow if we go a little bit slower and we think about it. So now you understand why, when you think about it, you're really doing the mitzvah right. Now you're really understanding why you put on the tzitzis and you shake the lulav. So you always have to ask. Remember this, that whenever you do a new mitzvah, whenever, you know, mommy and daddy tell you a new mitzvah, So ask them, why do I do this mitzvah? What does Hashem want to teach me with this mitzvah? Okay? So you have to keep asking questions, and then you'll do it slower, and you'll think about it while you're doing it. Okay, Yeshua?
Hello?
Ava, I want to say something else. Like, if you're doing something and you don't know how to do it, and it's, like, too hard for you, like you're not on the level of it. Like, if you're in first grade, you're trying to do something for people that are, like, in fifth grade or stuff, and you cannot do it, it's like, wasting your time. It's, like, when you do something, like, that, you waste your time because you're not ready for it. You could just move on and do something else and wait until you go on that level.
Right, that's what the rabbi said in the book that I'm reading. That's what he said. If you really have no idea, and Rashi also says that if a person does a mitzvah and he doesn't understand why, so it really has no meaning. But every time you start a new mitzvah, you're not going to know why you do it yet. See, now here comes a very important lesson. So whenever you learn a new mitzvah, what are you going to say? Well, I don't understand it. I'm not going to do it. Or do you say, let me start doing it and let me ask questions so I can learn more? What are you going to do?
Let me start questions so I can learn more.
Very good. Because that's always the case. Everybody, a little boy and a big man, everybody's always learning more and more. Nobody knows everything. Only Hashem knows everything. So whenever our whole life, there's always going to be a new mitzvah that we learn about. So then right away we should ask, why do I do it? How do I do it? And you ask the right questions and you ask the right people, you'll be able to get good answers. And it won't take too long to understand why you do it. Daryl, you got a question? Hello? I think, Daryl, you had a question there?
Yes, hold on there.
Oh, hello, Rabbi.
Yes. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just wondering, there's what you were saying before about needing kavana, needing intent when you do a mitzvah. Isn't that a machlokas between the rabbis? Or what you're saying is that originally, what is it, mitzvah tzarichus kavana, right? That doing mitzvah, you need intent, you need thought. So what you're saying is that initially, if you don't have the thought, it's okay, as long as you work your way up to that stage of having the kavana. But you shouldn't remain at the level of not understanding, because like you always stressed, the intellect was given to man, so you should use it.
Well, that statement of the rabbi is that dispute, whether or not a mitzvah requires intent or focus, I believe that's referring to the difference between prayer, for example, and shaking the esrog and the lulav. So in terms of prayer, where a person's, the activity is verbal, so if you don't have intent, your words, the whole thing is meaningless. But in terms of an activity where it's not verbal, and you're just moving an object, so there's a rabbi that says that just the moving alone is okay, because that you don't have to focus on the purpose, the objective, or even you don't have to focus on fulfilling this as a command. It's the action itself, which is what the command is. They commanded you in an action. But prayer, the command is that you're engaged your mind. So it's a different thing.
Understand.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Okay. Any other questions or comments before we wrap it up? Yes. Yeah, whoever's not speaking, please put on your mute, because I can't hear. Go ahead. Who is it, Doug?
Yeah, I was just thanking you.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. Yes, yeah, important topic.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Yeshua. Okay. Right, so I think we'll wrap it up, and I guess people have got their Thanksgiving dinners. Was that? Somebody have a question? Okay, I guess not. All right, so we sure we have a rest of your day. You should be, enjoy if you're going out for Thanksgiving dinners. Enjoy yourselves. Have a good day, a good weekend. And we will pick up on Sunday. Continue with Kohelis on Sunday.
I wanted to thank you, Rabbi. I really enjoyed the opportunity of asking questions and hearing other people's questions and hearing the answers. It was a very good way of spending the time. Thank you.
You're welcome. My pleasure. All right, so have a good day to everybody, and we'll pick up again 11:15 Eastern Time on Sunday with Luke Ellis.
Okay, thank you. Have a good day, everybody.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Hey, take care. Have a good day.
Gobble, gobble.
Have a good day.